Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. We are continuing our coverage of the coronavirus, which today the World Health Organization officially declared a global pandemic. The latest numbers from Massachusetts are 92 presumptive and confirmed cases. And at a meeting today, the state's Public Health Council granted the Department of Public Health Commissioner broad powers to act during the state of emergency that Governor Baker has declared. We are taking your calls all week, bringing you experts and updates that can answer your questions, clarify where possible, and get you the latest information. So call us at 1-800-423-8255. But let's start by checking in with WBUR reporters. And first up is Steve Brown, who was at today's Public Health Council meeting. He joins us now from the State House. Hey there, Steve.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Steve, the commissioner has been given broad powers. What does that mean?
Well, it means DPH Commissioner Dr. Monica Burrell doesn't have to go back to the Public Health Council for permission to take steps before acting. That includes imposing isolation orders. Now, after this morning's meeting, Burrell took a few questions from reporters. I asked her what she can do now that she couldn't do before.
With these new authorities, we are able to be prepared if we need to do something further. This gives us those tools to do that. So, for example, it allows us to have further interagency capacities to work in a coordinated way, as we have started to do. And it allows us to do things like offer isolation and quarantine at the state level, which local boards of health already have the authority. It really helps us be prepared for what may come our way.
Now, Commissioner Burrell says they still will be working closely with stakeholders to make sure that people understand what this outbreak means for them and to understand how they can keep themselves safe and protected.
And Steve, what does it mean for how the state will work with federal officials going forward on this?
Well, state public health officials will continue to work with the feds, especially the CDC, responding to this outbreak. The state has already asked the feds for supplies from the national stockpile. That's things like face masks and face shields, gowns and other protective gear for healthcare professionals. Of course, the state is also working with the CDC to allow them to increase the amount of testing that can be done here in Massachusetts. Now, as of yesterday, the state can complete roughly 50 tests a day. It's important to note that because they are now able to do more tests, that's the main reason that we saw a big jump in the numbers of cases yesterday here in Massachusetts. We'll probably see that today within the hour when the next set of numbers come out.
So in this constantly changing situation, Steve, public health officials have said that we now have community spread. How is the state addressing that?
Yeah, this is the new phase of the outbreak. Initially, it was just the folks who traveled to regions that had the coronavirus. People coming back from China and Italy began showing symptoms. A lot of those folks isolated themselves or quarantined themselves. It was pretty easy to figure out where those folks got the coronavirus. Now, there are some isolated spots. They're looking at an outbreak out in Berkshire County, where as of yesterday, 7 people were presumed to have COVID-19. They just don't know where that came from. Now, Commissioner Burrell explained what the state is doing about that.
We are working very closely with their healthcare personnel, their local board of health, and other stakeholders in the community to ensure that we are monitoring the individuals who have contracted COVID-19 and working to find their contacts and monitor their health situation and help them understand the parameters of their quarantines.
Now, Burrell says that they are working 24/7 to deal with the cases as they arise.
Steve, there were serious concerns raised today about the state's handling of the outbreak, especially regarding the Biogen meeting last month where several people contracted the virus. The Boston Globe is reporting that there were no confirmed cases of the virus related to the Biogen conference until attendees were attested outside of Massachusetts. Was Dr. Burrell asked about that, and what did she have to say?
Well, I tried to ask her about that during her brief scrum with reporters, but her press person ended the gaggle before I could get my question in. But otherwise, she's defending the state's handling of this so far. She says they're working collaboratively across the entire state. She says since the first case cropped up in China, they've been preparing and monitoring and doing surveillance. The DPH's incident command structure has been activated and is working across multiple sectors.
WBUR Steve Brown. Steve, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Colleges and universities around the region are shutting their doors and moving classes online at a rapid pace in response to the coronavirus. Today, the entire UMass system decided to move its classes online, followed by Northeastern and Berklee College of Music. At schools including Harvard and Smith, students are being asked not to return to their dorms, especially after spring break. Here to bring us the latest is WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin. Max, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Max, I listed some schools up there, and listeners can follow ongoing coverage of this on our website. But I want to ask you my favorite question in this moment. How big a deal is this?
Well, Joe Biden's in the news, and in honor of Joe Biden, I'd say it's a pretty big bleeping deal. We've got, by my count, almost 130,000 undergraduates who are now making hurried plans to get out of the state, or at least off of their campuses. You've got 9 of the state's 10 largest residential colleges being, in effect, evacuated. So it's this huge logistical process. But it's also a personal problem. For example, you have students who've made their campus a new home. I spoke to Kai DeLeon DeJesus, who is trans. She's on leave from Harvard, but she's worried that her network of queer friends just might not have anywhere good to return to.
Trying to figure out family situations and whether we all have homes that feel comfortable and safe for us, I think. I know a lot of people who just kind of see Cambridge and the people that they're with here as home now.
And so that's just one story. Then you've got at least several thousand international students, many of whom might be headed back to the virus's original epicenter in China. And there are far fewer flights, I'm told. And then you have almost 30,000 low-income students in that group, some of whom might have otherwise stayed on campus during spring break. Now they have to shell out money or arrange for grants to buy plane tickets, shipping, housing, food, you name it.
So this is really complicated, Max. Are colleges reimbursing students for housing costs if they have to move off campus? And as you just alluded to, what about students on scholarship, financial aid?
Yeah, it's all happening so quickly that I think it's unclear how well some of that stuff will be settled. But you've heard from Suffolk University, Smith College out west, and Harvard. They've all announced plans to offer prorated reimbursements for room and board. So basically refunding students for their last 2 months. And then you have visa issues. For instance, Northeastern, which just announced plans to close its campus today, they all but begged federal immigration officials late last week to confirm that their large population of international students wouldn't have trouble with F1 visas that they used to study here as a result of their leaving campus. Normally that would be a problem. And on Monday, they got confirmation from ICE, which administers the program. And it was a rare bit of good news. I spoke with Jagisha Patel, who oversees Northeastern's international students at the university's Office of General Counsel. You can hear that tape.
We wanted to make sure that students did not feel like they had to compromise their safety, their health and well-being to be physically on campus. So this was something that we felt was really important to not cause additional stress and concerns and anxiety.
So the federal finding, Tiziana, says international students won't have visa issues as a result of doing all online education. It should apply to all certified colleges that educate those kinds of students, but still there are fears. And just today, Harvard's grad student union called on administrators to offer similar assurances to their international students.
So, Max, faculty, professors now have to move their classes online. I'm assuming that some are more prepared to do that than others. Is it an easy process to suddenly go online across the board at all these universities?
I would not say easy, Tiziana. I mean, it might be easy for places like Harvard and MIT that have a rich tradition of doing that over the course of the past decade. But in any event, you're asking a group of professors with diverse life experiences, sometimes advanced in age and maybe really tech phobic, to suddenly adopt this new technology and new ways of teaching. I spoke to Justin Reich, who's one of the leading experts on online learning over at MIT. And he says it may look like a neat technical solution in this crisis, but it will raise a whole host of human problems. We can hear that tape.
You should only try to shift to digital learning if you really think that you can support all of your students, all of your students in the most rural areas, all of the students with the most difficult home life, all the students with special education needs and individualized education plans. And for all but the most affluent districts, if you do that analysis, you're going to find that you can't support all of your students.
So Tiziana, Reich also said that many schools, you know, that might not be totally equipped to make this rapid pivot should just say no to this wave of taking courses online. Instead, they should look for creative ways for students to read and study and use their minds while they're away, and then just make up for the lost learning time when they're back on campus and the crisis has blown over.
So far, we've really been focusing on, you know, four-year public and private universities. What about community colleges, commuter schools?
I think because it's a different model, they've had a different response. Right now, I'd say the state's community colleges seem to be where those big private and public a few days ago. So they've suspended official travel in many cases. They've asked community members to self-quarantine if they get sick, but they haven't moved class online or closed their campus, anything more dramatic like that.
Okay, Max, I'm actually going to have to stop you there. That is WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin. Max, thanks.
Thank you.
We know you have coronavirus questions, so we are continuing this series we've been doing of call-in segments with area doctors. Today, we have experts with particular knowledge about travel. But whatever your coronavirus question may be, call us. We are at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Here to help us on the line is Dr. Natasha Hochberg. She's Associate Professor of Medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine, the Program Director for the Infectious Disease Fellowship Program, and Co-Director of Boston Medical Center's Travel Clinic. Dr. Hochberg, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much.
And on the line is Dr. Lynn Chen. She is the director of the Travel Medicine Center at Mount Auburn Hospital, president of the International Society of Travel Medicine, and an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Chen, welcome to you, too.
Thank you.
And again, call with your questions, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. The callers are already on the line, so let's jump right in. We've got Jim from Newton. Jim, what's your question?
Hi, I understand that in Massachusetts they've developed a test for the virus and that they are administering it, but then they have to send the test to Atlanta to verify it. What I don't understand is this. Why can't they develop a verification method in Massachusetts so we don't have to get involved with sending it to Atlanta and waiting the additional days?
Thanks for that call, Jim. Dr. Hochberg, is that something that you can help us with?
Sure, absolutely. So I think the issue of diagnostic testing has been a tricky one. You know, unfortunately, the initial testing that was sent out was not optimal. Fortunately, we now actually have the capability of doing testing at the health department. You're right, we have to do confirmatory testing at CDC, but there are additional diagnostic tests that are being brought online from commercial labs as well. So we're hoping that the testing capability ramps up markedly. So sort of a brief, you know, answer to that.
Dr. Hochberg, just quickly before we take our next call, over what time frame do we have an expectation of that testing capacity ramping up? Do you know?
It sounds like it's over the next few days, but it's still a work in progress, so we haven't received a definite date, but it's happening.
All right, let's take another call. We've got Charlotte on the line from Jacksonville, Alabama. Charlotte, welcome to Radio Boston. What's your question?
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I have a 30-year-old son in Seattle, Washington, who is planning on flying to Florida day after tomorrow. He has a history of severe respiratory infections, pneumonia several times, has to use a nebulizer several times a year. He thinks he'll be okay if he gets tested today there and will wash his hands a lot when he's on the flight. What are your thoughts of the doctor's thoughts about flying, and it's to visit family and not for work?
Thanks for that, Charlotte. Let's turn to Dr. Chen for that. Dr. Chen, can you field that question, please?
Yes. So this COVID-19 has been such an been evolving so rapidly, and I think there is great concern that people who potentially may be shedding the virus may transmit to others. Now, if your son has chronic respiratory infection, it may be difficult to differentiate that from coronavirus, a new coronavirus infection. So I think one of the first questions to ask is, how critical is this trip? How necessary is this trip? How important, how essential is this trip? And is there a better time for doing this? Is there increased risk for him at the destination, or is there potential of carrying the disease with him? Is there potential that he cannot return if illness comes over? And so I think those are some of the first questions.
So, Dr. Chen, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. It sounds like you're saying that should the answer to, for example, is this a really important trip or one that needs to be taken now? If the answer to that is no, it sounds like you're saying probably better not to do it. Am I understanding you correctly?
That's right. So I think Washington State has significant cases going on and community transmission of COVID-19. So there is certainly concern that he may be carrying the infection.
Let's take another call, and thank you for that, Dr. Chen. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your question of Drs. Chen and Hochberg. We have Jennifer on the line from Cambridge. Jennifer, what is your question?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I'm pregnant, and I'm just wondering, I know pregnant women are normally considered higher risk, but on the CDC website, there's actually not a ton of data to say that that's true. Should I be taking more precautions than other people?
That is a really interesting question. Dr. Hochberg, can I turn that one to you, please?
Sure, absolutely. So congratulations on your pregnancy. In terms of the data about what we know about pregnancy, there does not seem to be an effect. So they have not isolated the virus. They haven't found the virus either in amniotic fluid, you know, the sac surrounding the fetus. They haven't found it in cord blood. They haven't found it in breast milk. So it looks like the sort of the impact on pregnant women is sort of, you know, we're not seeing a strong impact there. I would emphasize, though, this is sort of just to highlight something that Dr. Chen had picked up on in terms of people that are higher risk. Those individuals really are people that are older adults, those with high blood pressure, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and lung disease primarily. So those are the groups that we're really considering high risk at this point.
So we are taking your calls on coronavirus and travel. And with us today is Dr. Natasha Hochberg, who is, among other things, Associate Professor of Medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine, and Dr. Lin Chen, who, among other things, is Director of the Travel Medicine Center at Mount Auburn Hospital. If you'd like to call in with a question, it's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sorry about that. Calls keep coming. So we have Jennifer on the line from Toronto, Canada. Jennifer, what's your question for the doctors?
Hi. So my husband, my 10-month-old child, and I are scheduled to go to Boston in about 10 days from a family function. There are going to be people there from all the way down the Eastern Seaboard and multiple locations in Canada. I'm not super worried about our health. We're all young and quite healthy. I am worried about my responsibility to not become a vector. To what extent should I be concerned that if I'm going to an event like this, I could then become responsible for sort of spreading this?
It's a really thoughtful question, Jennifer. Dr. Chen, would you be willing to answer that, please?
Yes. Thank you for that question. I think you raise a really important question, and I think many people who have travel plans are reassessing what are our responsibilities as travelers. Can we become vectors of this particular infection, even if we are relatively low risk? And I think that's a really, really difficult situation just because of the evolving situation. And so now that there is a state of emergency in Massachusetts, and then there are so many concerns about cases with community transmission here, I think you raised such a valid point. I'm not sure I have a clear answer for you. I think everybody needs to reassess their travel and consider what might be the best option for them. If it's a very small, say, reunion or gathering with just a family, that might potentially be reasonable. But if it's attending a large meeting, a large gathering, where people from all walks of life are meeting together and unclear who might have might be carrying the virus, I think that then the threat may be higher.
Let's continue taking calls. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Caitlin from Medford, what's your question for the doctors today?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is really similar to the one that just preceded it, actually. I was planning a trip down to New York City this weekend for a wedding of one of my very best friends, and I'm kind of torn of what would be, you know, the more unsocially acceptable option, to miss a wedding or to potentially carry or pick up this virus.
These are such tough questions. Dr. Hochberg, since it's a similar question, let's give it to you this time so we can hear both of your perspectives on this.
Sure. I think that's really tricky. I do tend to agree with Dr. Chen, though, that you have a social responsibility for the people that you're going to see. And presumably, if there's a wedding or there's a family reunion, you're going to have a mix of younger adults, but also older adults that are potentially at higher risk, or people with those, you know, conditions like heart disease and things that put them at higher risk. So, you know, I think that there is concern about potential transmission and being in a large group setting. So I think that there's other ways to show your, you know, your love and support for the couple. And so I think it's it might be worth a conversation with them to sort of say, listen, I want to be there and support you, but maybe this isn't the best time to do it.
I don't want to sound silly, but it almost seems like in that case, there's the opportunity to say, my state has declared a state of emergency. We're very concerned about contagion in my state, and I don't want to miss your wedding, but, you know, that increases the threshold. Does something like that help in these painful social situations where you've got to think about other people's feelings as well, Dr. Hochberg?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think, you know, we've moved from a state of what's called containment, where we can really try to isolate cases, to sort of this mitigation phase where we really have to think about this social distancing and addressing large gatherings of people and whether that really makes sense at this point. And so I think that your point is absolutely correct about a potential way to address it with the bride and groom.
And I admit that that's complicated. One of our producers just reminded me this second that New York State also has a state of emergency, and that's where the wedding is. So I think it's probably going to continue to be a little messy for a while. Let's go ahead and take another call. We've got Linda on the line from Brookline. Linda, please go ahead. What's your question?
Hi, my question is, I'm wondering if someone coughs at me, say, on the subway, and I get exposed, what's the incubation period? When do I see symptoms in myself if I get exposed? An hour, 12 hours, 24, 3 days? I have no idea.
Thanks for that, Tracy. It's a good question. Linda, it's a good question. Dr. Chen, can you help us with that one?
Yeah, so the typical incubation period is considered to be between 2 days to 14 days, but mostly around 3 to 5 days.
So if one feels one has been exposed, and let's say it's day 8 and you're not showing any symptoms, Dr. Chen, do you assume you're out of the woods, or do you assume that you need a few more days to be sure?
I think you need a few more days to be sure.
Okay, that's really helpful. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's keep the calls coming. We got Tracy on the line from Plymouth. Tracy, what's your question?
Hi, I'm just interested in learning more about, you know, the school closures, the college closures. It seems that the value in those is the social distancing. So without any community restrictions associated with them, we're just taking all those people and putting them out into different communities and different social situations. So how can we make those actually be effective?
Great question. Dr. Hochberg, would you like to address that?
Sure. I think that's it's a great point. School closures won't be effective if then children from those schools are all gathering in other social situations. So I think that that's one of the factors that makes it difficult to think about school closures, and that health authorities have to factor in. Do children that are taken out of school have a place to go to where they can be safe and where they can, frankly, not infect anybody else potentially at home? And
We also have to factor in the workforce, so whether or not parents can actually stay home with their children, but maybe these are people that play an important role potentially at hospitals or other vital settings, and so they can't actually stay with home with their kids. So there's many factors that go into the question of school closures, and I think that health authorities are grappling with them right now.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Stephen on the line from Gardner, Massachusetts. Stephen, what is your question?
Hi. So my question is, really, I go to the gym about 4 or 5 times a week, and I'm wondering what the likelihood of catching it on a gym mat or a bench press or anything like that is there.
Dr. Chen, Dr. Hochberg, who's the right one to answer that question for Stephen?
I think Dr. Hochberg might be...
Sure. That's fine. Yeah, so I think that there's sort of information coming out about, you know, whether you're likely to be infected when you're at a gym. We know this virus can live on surfaces, so the question is going to be how much is a gym practicing cleaning and sort of environmental management to address that possibility. So what are they using bleach wipes? How frequently are they using them? Are they wiping down all of the surfaces? Because there is the potential for the virus to sort of get on there. You're also in close proximity to other individuals, and you really don't know their health status. So that being said, if you stay away from other individuals at the gym, you're doing a really good job of sort of wiping down anything that you're touching. You're, you know, very good about not touching your face. I think those are precautionary measures that you can put in place. And frankly, those are really important measures for everybody. I think we're all learning and we're all reminding our children of the importance of washing your hands and washing them regularly and not touching your face and coughing into your arm. So I think those are measures that apply at the home, at school, and also at the gym.
Dr. Chen, that makes me think of similar types of, you know, the questions of touching equipment when it comes to travel, too. So you got a tray table in front of you on an airplane. You have the backseat of an Uber and the things that you might be touching touching there. You know, a number of travel-related situations where it's not just what's in the air, but what you're touching that previous people have touched. What is the level of concern and what kinds of precautions should people take?
Thank you. I agree with Dr. Hochberg. If it's a public surface where multiple people may have touched, may have had contact, and droplets have fallen on them, then there is potential concern. With coronavirus, there's still a lot of uncertainty and a lot of unknowns about how long this virus survives on surfaces and what type of surface, because there may be variations. So the prudent thing is for everybody to try to minimize touching, directly touching surfaces that multiple people may have had contact with while you're traveling. And that includes being in taxis and airplanes and trains, and also to wipe down places where you might touch directly yourself, and washing hands, again, just as Dr. Hochberg said, before touching your face, and washing hands really well.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, to ask a question of Dr. Natasha Hochberg and Dr. Lynn Chen. We have Bill on the line from Chelmsford. Bill, what's your question?
I'm an 80-year-old man traveling with a 71-year-old woman who's a healthcare worker. We're planning to travel tomorrow from Boston to Jacksonville, Florida. Is it risky for us to be traveling? We're both in good health.
Thanks for that question, Bill. Either doctor who would like to answer that, please.
Sure. So I think because of your age, unfortunately, you are at higher risk if you were to become infected. So I think if you do need to travel, I think the important thing is sort of reiterating the things that Dr. Chen and I have discussed of wiping down the surfaces, washing your hands frequently, not touching your face, avoiding other individuals as much as you can, sort of social distancing measures. If it's possible to delay your trip, that might make sense. Interestingly, there's some data to suggest that if you were to sit in the window seat of an airplane, there's the potential potential for less transmission because people are less likely to sort of be going by you, potential less sort of contact with other people's hands and the surfaces that they're touching. So if you can sit in a window seat, but I think that if it's possible for you to delay your travel, that might make sense.
And Dr. Hochberg, if Bill and his companion do have to go tomorrow, you said wipe things down. Just to, again, be really practical and clear, wipe them down with what? What should they be using to wipe down that tray table or the armrest on their seats, et cetera?
Yep, they should be using a bleach wipe, so not just sort of a wet wipe, but an actual bleach wipe. And if you take a look, CDC has some great information about sort of how long the surface has to stay wet, what kind of bleach wipe is going to be sufficient, and that I would just sort of underscore the value of looking to CDC and looking to the Department of Public Health websites to get accurate information. There's a lot of inaccurate information circling around, and so I would urge people to look to those reputable sites to get your information.
I'd like to get one or two more calls in. We've got Poe on the line from Fitchburg. Poe, what's your question?
Yeah, my question is my family and I are planning a vacation trip in April, go on a Carnival cruise. And, you know, with the whole talk about coronavirus, and I know if we cancel our travel, I know we're going to lose everything. And if we do go, what kind of precautions should I take or what should I do?
All right, Dr. Chen, how about you for this one?
So the Diamond Princess, I think many people have heard about the high rates of positives that in passengers who were on that cruise. So I think there's a great concern about cruises. I would think the cruise ship companies have probably very likely have ramped up their procedures in terms of decontamination and cleansing. But I think because you're going in April, and that is quite soon, until all the outbreaks have settled down, it's somewhat unclear to me that we could be sure that people going on the cruise along with you will be perfectly healthy. And so I think it's it would be better to postpone this trip if I were you.
Thank you for that, Dr. Chen.
Reiterate one thing. So Dr. Fauci, who runs the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases of the NIH, recommended that people really not go on cruises. So I would underscore what Dr. Chen said.
Perfect. Thank you. I'd like to get one more call in. We've got Jody on the line from Cohasset. Jody, please go ahead.
Thank you. I have two questions. My son is 21 and healthy, a West Virginia University student who's been told not to return from spring break, which begins on Saturday. He's scheduled to fly home. He would have to take an hour and a half bus ride to the airport and then fly home. I just don't know if we should go get him. And my second question relates to myself. I'll be 68 in June. I have high blood pressure that is treated with medication. Am I still in a high risk, considered high risk when I'm otherwise healthy?
Good questions, Jody. I'd like to take them in reverse order. Dr. Hochberg on the high risk and blood pressure, and then Dr. Chen about driving to West Virginia to get the sun versus flying. Dr. Hochberg?
Yeah, so in terms of your high blood pressure, unfortunately, that does still put you at higher risk. There are some interesting studies coming out about whether or not certain blood pressure medicines will actually be beneficial for people if they are infected, but we don't have those data. There's some data from similar viruses, but we don't know that yet. And so at this point, I would still consider yourself to be in a higher risk group, and I would just urge you to follow all of those preventive things that we've talked about, staying away from crowds, washing your hands, not touching your face. And also I would say, you know, one thing is probably just if you were to get sick, you want to let your doctor know, to give them a call and say, listen, you know, I have high blood pressure. I'm in my 60s. Do you want me to come in to get seen? So that's just one more point, I think, to underscore for everybody that you don't necessarily want to go to your doctor right away. If you get a fever and cough, I think it makes more sense to call and to have the doctor triage over the phone.
All right. Thank you for that. And Dr. Chen, the other part of the question, going to pick up the young person in Virginia versus the student flying home.
Right. Was that West Virginia, I believe?
Yes.
I think the West Virginia has not identified cases. So if he were to fly home, that's probably reasonable. In the Boston area or in Massachusetts, we actually have more a greater risk right now. This is a situation that continues to change and may change in hours, if not within the next couple of days. And the as far as the bus ride goes, I don't know the exact itinerary, but I think if he can take all the precautions on the flight and on the bus in terms of not touching his face, washing his hands well, and I think he can minimize his risk of being exposed to coronavirus. Having said that, I think if you are feeling uncomfortable for him to be in these public conveyances, and if you are able to pick him up by driving, I think that's certainly a fine alternative.
All right. And callers, thanks so much for calling in today. That is Dr. Lynn Chen. She is the director of the Travel Medicine Center at Mount Auburn Hospital, president of the International Society of Travel Medicine, and associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Chen, thank you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Natasha Hochberg, associate professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine, program director for the Infectious Disease Fellowship Program, and co-director of Boston Medical Center's Travel Clinic. Thank you to you too, Dr. Hochberg.
Thanks so much.
In author Gish Jen's newest novel, A Dystopian Society with a Sentient Internet Overlord Meets Baseball. Her latest work is called The Resistors, and Gish Jen joins us now from her home in Cambridge to talk about it. Welcome, Gish.
Oh, my pleasure.
So I loved this book. It was fascinating. It was complex. It was fun. And in it, you create this world called Auto America. And it's like all of our biggest fears around climate change, AI, automation, all kind of in one perfect storm. Can you describe for readers what this world is like?
Well, so this is a world sort of maybe, you know, 10 or, well, no, 40 or 50 years in the future, right? And among other things, it's a world in which, you know, we have 4G internet now, we have 5G being rolled out. Well, if you imagine kind of a 9 or a 10 or 11G where, you know, the internet has been rolled up together with many features of AI and automation and Alexa, all these things have all kind of become integrated, right? And so this, they've become integrated in an entity known, what they call the AutoNet, which is referred to affectionately as Aunt Nettie. And Aunt Nettie is an entity such that nobody can really function without it. You know, that's true of the internet now, but it's, of course, even more true then. And then there's a class of people who still have jobs, and they are kind of affiliated with Aunt Nettie, and they're called the netted. And then there's a whole group of people who do not have jobs, and they are called the surplus.
So when we say dystopian,
so it's kind of our income,
we
our
mean
income
it.
Inequality made much worse. Yes, it is. It's very dystopian. Yes. Although I will say that within my dystopia, there's kind of a utopia. You know, it's my book is kind of both.
Yeah, and I want that. Actually, that's straight onto what I wanted to say next, because I've read a lot of dystopian novels. I have two young adults at home, and that's kind of the jam for young adults as well. But they are dark, and this didn't feel like there was a dark cloud over my head while I was reading it. It's both dystopian but not despairing and somehow hopeful. How did you do that and why?
Well, I mean, the why, you know, that's just me, you know. And I will say also, you know, it really is. But I will say also that, you know, I was writing this at a time when my own daughter had just gone off into college. And so, you know, I was both looking at the world that she was entering, you know, with great trepidation. I mean, I do think that the cloud over this book is quite dark. At the same time, you know, I'm looking at these young people going out in the world, and, you know, they get it about climate change. You don't have to tell them. You know, they're very well prepared. They're very politically savvy. So there's a lot, you know, there's a reason that I'm also hopeful. So, you know, like you said, and I think that you can see that schizophrenia quite clearly in my book.
You talked a minute ago about how people in the book can't live without Aunt Nettie and all of this automated world around them. And some of that is sort of by evolution and some of it's by design. When I was reading the book, I thought, is this what Gish Jen thinks is what's going to happen as a result of the Internet of Things? Is this what the Internet of Things is going to do over time?
Well, obviously, I hope not, right? I mean, so this is not a prediction, you know, this is a nightmare, you know, so this, you know, it's a thought exercise. So, you know, what I hope with this book is that people could look at this and think, oof, you know, this could happen. Let's make sure it doesn't happen, you know? So, you know, our job is to make sure that, yeah, climate change doesn't become so bad that, you know, all low-lying places are flooded and we only have these marooned places, you know, here and there, to which we can kayak if we want to have a baseball game. You know, we're actually trying to avoid this. And similarly, you know, we're trying to avoid a world where, you know, the internet controls us. You know, I mean, the internet is, as I point out in the book, you know, it's something we invented, you know. You know, it's not the earth that did this or any other creature. We did this and we can undo it.
So I want to talk about baseball for a minute. The story centers on the experiences of one surplus family. You defined those terms earlier for us. The mom is Eleanor is a social justice focused lawyer. Her husband, Grant, is the narrator of the book. Their daughter, Gwen, is a girl with a golden arm. She's an incredible pitcher from a very, very young age. And it kind of feels logical as you read the book that America's favorite pastime becomes the favorite form of resistance in this post, I don't know, apocalyptic or whatever you want to call it, America. Yeah. Did you do that on purpose, and why baseball?
Well, you know, of course, you know, I've been interested in writing about America from the get-go. And so baseball's a great national pastime. It makes sense, right? And there is a way in which baseball, you know, embodies many of our democratic ideals, you know, the whole idea that we should have a level playing field, that everyone should have a chance at bat, that, you know, that we can have an arena that's governed by rules that to which everyone consents, and that, you know, the rules that are carefully set up to bring out the best in us, you know. So there's, you know, there's a lot about baseball. Also, I will say the sense of possibility in baseball that's, you know, sort of that just makes sense from the thematic point of view. But I will say also that, you know, that baseball has always occupied a special place in my family, my immigrant family.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm very aware of the way that, you know, baseball, that we have an attachment to baseball to this day. You know, my parents are Chinese immigrants. And, you know, my mother particularly, you know, first kind of performed Americanness by going to a baseball game and having a hot dog. And, you know, and that blossomed, as it will. I mean, it's not just my family. It's happened in many immigrant families, into kind of like an obsession with baseball. This is so true in my mother's case that I will say a couple of years ago, my mother's in her 90s, and my mother was in septic shock. And she was lying there, you know, completely non-responsive, and we're all rushing to her bedside, and a priest has been called in. It's very, very serious. And, you know, my brother was trying to get her to respond. Mm-hmm. He's just trying to get her to, you know, and he leans over her, and what does he say to her? He says, "Mom," he says, "the Yankees are in a slump." He says, "The Red Sox are eating their lunch." And sure enough, my mother opens her eyes and bat, without missing a beat, she says, "That Aaron Boone should be fired." You know, Aaron Boone, of course, is the manager of the Yankees. And I mean, when I say that this form of Americanness kind of got embedded in my family, I mean it. So, yeah. You know, I really kind of understand what, you know, what baseball means, you know, the way that it is kind of synonymous with America and with democracy, in this very visceral way.
Gish, I'd like to ask you to read a short passage. It takes place at one of the baseball games. This is Gwen's team, the Lookouts, playing against her friend Ondi's team, the Thistles. Did I say that right? Is it Ondi?
Yeah, I usually say Ondi.
So I always, I wondered. Gwen is at the pitcher's mound. Ondi is up to bat. They think they're alone, but then a drone flies overhead. Will you read that for us?
Yeah, there's a nosy drone, and, you know, and the father, Grant, says, "Was this the excuse I needed to suspend the game?" I watched out of the corner of my eye as the drone hovered overhead for several moments. Though a few people looking up appeared rattled, Gwen didn't seem to notice. Strike two. The drone zipped off to the west. Gwen wound up one more time, and fast as the ball was moving, 71 miles per hour by my meter, Ondi, accustomed to Gwen's pitches, managed to connect with it. She did not get in a full swing, but she made enough contact that her bat broke and flew off in pieces, even as the ball hit a tuft of weeds at a funny angle and spinning, bounced back in front of the catcher, who picked it up, stepped on home plate, and threw to first. 2 ounce. So deep were our sighs of relief, our lawn chairs squeaked. And though the Thistles went on to win in extra innings, we didn't care. We were just glad when it was all over.
That passage does such a great job of capturing the embeddedness or juxtaposition of the innocence of childhood moments, of joy of playing something like baseball, with this oppressive sense of surveillance, constantly being under watch, constantly having to resist. Where in that continuum do we think you think we are today? And what are you thinking cautiously about?
Well, of course, I'm concerned about, you know, the way that our data is being scraped off without our knowledge often and being used, right? And I don't think people realize that, you know, when they Google things, you know, a lot of those queries are being captured. You know, people think they're in private and they're not. Or, you know, for instance, people who have any kind of assisted device on their browser, you know, because they are dyslexic or because they're visually impaired, anything like that, you know, that stuff is all known to various companies, and sure, yes, you know, it's being used against them. It's being used to, you know, raise their rates on various things, and you know, and people are not aware of that. So, you know, I do wish that that we had a little more public awareness, that we had a little more legislation. I mean, I know people who are working on privacy from the technological end, and that's great, but it can't be handled only by technology. We also need legislation.
So the Resistors is also about race, class, gender. I want to focus on race for a second. The Netted are described as angel fare. They work, they go to college. The Surplus are described as darker skin, darker hair, sometimes copper-toned. You've really segregated the United States in this novel by race. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, let me point out that actually some of the Surplus are also angel fare. In other words, it's not that the Surplus are all people of color or people who are, as I say in the book, odd-bodied,
yeah,
or odd-godded. But it is true that the upper class, the people with jobs, the netted, are uniformly angel fare. And, you know, this is just, I mean, I'm so sorry to say that, you know, if you just look at the world, you know, look at Silicon Valley, I mean, this is unfortunately all too possible a reality, you know. I mean, I do think that there is a way in which, you know, racial lines become economic lines.
I thought about the fact that when one becomes netted or tries to become netted, one has a chance to become angel fare, to use, you know, technology to change your appearance, to change how you look to the world. We do a lot of that now, even just the filters on Snapchat. Are we losing a piece of our essence? And is that at all a part of the message of this book?
Well, you know, I don't like to think of a book in terms of messages, but of course, you know, in the book, people can get a permaderm, complete change. And that's not so different than what, you know, if you look at the young people in China today, they're all using those whitening creams. I mean, it's frightening, really, the degree to which they've been able to lighten their skin. Sometimes you'll see that, you know, because they use it mostly on their face and not so much on their neck. You know, sometimes you'll see that face is very, very white. And then just below their chin, they appear to be a completely different color. And, you know, and there's also, a lot of operations on people's noses, on people's eyes. So, you know, the idea that you can have a permaderm, unfortunately, does not seem so far-fetched.
I know that this is your most recent book, and you're still talking a lot about it. People are reading it. Any idea, though, of what's next for you?
I don't know. I have to sit down and be very, very quiet and see, you know, kind of what my strongest signal is.
All right. That's Gish Jen. She's a Cambridge-based author, and The Resistors is her 8th book. Thanks for joining us today, Gish.
My pleasure.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Matt Lissette. Hitesh Hathi is our executive producer. I'm the host, Tiziana Deering, and we hope you will join us tomorrow for more Radio Boston.